If you meet a straight person for the first time, you can kind of imagine the things that they might choose to bring up. But you meet a queer person for the first time and it could go anywhere and you could, you know.
Hello, my name is Kate Anderson and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So, if you happened to be a drag queen and you wanted to get more gigs for yourself, what would you do? Well, if you are this week's guest, the answer is really quite simple. You create your own night. Easy. Why the hell wouldn't you? That doesn't sound stressful at all. No. So if I've just triggered you by saying what I've just said, let me reassure you quickly. We're not talking about just any old drag queen here. We are talking about someone who loves a checklist almost as much as I do. And I don't think there's many people out there who love a checklist as much as I do. Anyway, our guest is Zelda Moon, who is the co-host of the Death to Everyone podcast. And we have already met her co-host, Lazy Susan, on last week's episode. And she is also a huge lover of K-pop and J-pop music. And so, somewhere at the beginning of her career, she got the bright idea to throw a night celebrating this music called Genki, which she held at Melbourne's Hugs and Kisses. And then, world domination, smooth sailing, instant success and fame. Only, not really. More like lots and lots of hard work. Why don't we get into the conversation to find out more? I'm going to embrace my grumpy old man side and ask a question about K-pop and J-pop. I'm one of those people who's like, well, if I don't know the lyrics, what's the point in listening to this song?
Yeah, right.
So I like kind of understand it, but I kind of don't understand it. Mm-hmm. So can you explain it to me like I'm a five-year-old and like maybe explain everything to me like a five-year-old for this entire conversation?
Okay, well, for me, I think pop music is fun but stupid, and one of the things I dislike about like the super generic pop music from the West is the like inane lyrics of like, hey, we're in a party, hold your drinks in the air, woo. And it's an entire genre that like feels just as happy, but I don't know what they're saying. So it could be stupid or it could be profound, but I'm not caught up in that as I listen. I can just enjoy the beat.
Oh, but so it's a rejection of the inanity of Western pop music.
Yeah, pretty much. Because you still get to listen to pop music, but you don't have to think about how ridiculously stupid it is.
And so when did you realize that you liked J-pop and K-pop?
Well, I think like growing up, I like have always played a lot of video games, right? And most of those are made in Japan. And then like same with like anime, and there's kind of like a gateway drug there of like, who did the theme song for this anime? And then you look into what else they've done, or like who did the soundtrack for this video game? And then you go from there. Yeah. And then as I kind of discovered more, I was like, oh, this is, yeah, I like it. I like how it sounds.
Okay. Interesting.
You've not listened to much K-pop or J-pop?
No, not really. I will admit that. And so you liked it enough that you wanted to put on your own night.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that idea come from?
So I think I was maybe a year or two into performing in drag. And this was, like 8-9 years ago. And there's kind of, you know, like you can either wait to be given opportunities or you can seek them out yourself. And I kind of thought, well, wouldn't it be amazing if I could go out for a night and listen to all of this music that I love? And then I also thought, well, wouldn't it be great if I had a gig on ever? Yeah, so in the early days, I was like, all right, well, why don't I just make those two things happen at the same time? Yeah, and kind of started throwing this party that, one, was a gig, obviously, and two, I was like, well, I can curate it with all these DJs and music and performances that celebrate, yeah, like this niche kind of genre of music that also, you know, like stepping on anyone else's toes in the scene who are running other club nights, like it has its own kind of point of view. And yeah, so it kind of did both of those things.
But wait a minute, you didn't lip sync to songs that you didn't know the words to, did you?
Yeah, it's like my specialty. of which I will like always find out what the lyrics are. But yeah, I like lip syncing in foreign languages, like my jam. I love it. It's so fun. It's such a challenge. And when you can get it down, it's the best.
Okay, so let's find out about you at this point in time. So you'd said that you were about a year into performing, and you were like hustling up gigs. Mm-hmm. So getting into drag.
Yeah.
What was the motivation? Like, were you wanting to take over the world, or was it just a fun thing?
It was...
Or somewhere in between.
Yeah, somewhere in between. There's always a bit of world domination in any performer, I think.
Obvi.
Yeah, but I started going to a club night called Pandora's Box, and they were queer parties that always had performers and drag queens, but every party had a dress-up theme. And so as I was going, I would get dressed up more and more and more to the point of doing, you know, like... full drag. And then that party was kind of coming to an end, and yeah, I've been going to this party for years and I loved it, and I was, you know, sad to see it end. And I asked if I could perform at the final one, which I did. And yeah, from there I was like, oh, well, okay, this was great. I'd like to keep doing this. And then, yeah, I kind of hustled from there to do more gigs. Yeah. But it was, yeah, such a little scene, and I think that kind of was something that I tried to model my party after as well, of like a mix of seasoned performers and a chance for new people to get a go, and just creating a space every couple months for people to, yeah, get together. But
and so did anyone like take you under their wing and teach you the ways, or were you just like a self-made? Like, I'm always fascinated about how this works.
Yeah, not so much for me. Like, at that time, I hadn't yet studied makeup, but that is something that I did do a couple of years later.
a couple of years?
Yeah. But it was fine. It was fine. Natural talent, you know. Also, not if you looked at the photos, but it's okay. Yeah, no, I really just, like, there was that scene of people, and I kind of admired them, but I wasn't necessarily part of it yet. I don't think it was till I did that first gig where I then kind of, like, they looked at me differently, rather than someone who was just going to these events as like someone who, you know, is part of them. But that's also exactly how I would want it. I kind of like, I would never want to show someone the ways in drag or to be shown. I'm quite happy just doing it myself. Like, I work with other drag queens really, really closely, and I have like some incredible drag sisters, but that relationship I love. But the actual like mentoring or being mentored is, yeah, that's not really for me, I don't think.
Why?
Because leave me alone. Don't tell me what to do.
Really?
Yeah, no. And I think like I would hate to be influenced by someone else's vision of what's entertaining or how to do this or that or whatever. You know, I'm glad that I kind of found that for myself, because it is truly that. It's like my vision for this art form, for me, decided by me. Yeah.
But you know that a mentor isn't someone who tells you what to do. It's someone who guides you, right?
Yeah, but I also...
Do you have problems with authority figures?
Not really, but maybe I do. No, I think it's just, it's also like finding that right person. Like the scene isn't, you know, like we're in Australia, the scene just isn't that big. So it's like maybe the right person wasn't here. Even though there are certainly queens that I admired from that time, would any of them be close enough to my personal vision of drag that I would want to have built that relationship with them? Probably not. And not in like a snobby way, but just in a like, oh, I don't know, we're just into different things. So I don't know that we would have connected to build that relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know like I'm lightly teasing you here, but like lots of what you say totally resonates with me because I am one of those people that's like, no, I just need to forge my own path and like fuck up in my own way and figure it out as I go rather than relying this. Yeah, there's some resistance from me on relying on other people or asking too much of people. And so I kind of just am like, I just need to lock myself in a room and figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I totally understand that. I think that's a similar place where I'm coming from. Yeah.
Does that mean that we're both broken or does that mean that we're both like independent women?
A strong, independent, broken women, perhaps. Yeah.
Why not both?
Yeah, why not both? But yeah, I think like the thing that's great about just doing it on your own is then like when you fail or when you succeed, it's entirely on you, and I really love that. And when you come out and kill it or build a career from nothing, it's like, well, yeah, I did that by myself. Not that it's a problem asking for help or receiving help, but yeah, I'm like, I just, yeah, it's how I operate, I suppose.
Okay, so then this first gig that you did at this night that was ending, what was it? What was your performance?
What was my performance? So my debut performance was a 10-minute mega mix, and it was like, okay, so I'm doing drag, and this might be the one and only time that I ever get to do a drag show, so I want to put everything in it that I want to put in it. So it started off with like a theme from Zelda, and then it went into a K-pop song, and then it went into a Jennifer Lopez song, and then there was like dialogue from a Seinfeld episode. And then there was a K-pop song at the end. And yeah, it was just like all this stuff, like 2 minutes from each of my favorite things, basically.
Okay, so you started small then. Like, what was the feeling in the lead up to that?
It was exciting. It was like, it was a mixture of like, oh, I'm really excited to be doing this, but the reason I'm doing it is sad, like to say goodbye to this event. But yeah, it was just exciting. And, you know, sometimes you can really hustle and get a big group of your friends there. And they're always, you know, the most fun gigs because they're the people that you want to impress the most. Yeah, and it was this room of friends and supporters and it was fab. And then after it, I was like, okay, well, I need to do this again somehow. Yeah,
so talk me through the performance then. What was going on in your head whilst you were up there doing the number? Other than, fuck, I've got another 9 minutes to go.
Yeah. Well, there were quite a few props, reveals, all extremely messy, of course. And, like, you can do drag shows in a very easy, simple way, or you can overcomplicate them for minimal benefit. But it was like, okay, so I need the boa for this bit, so I'm going to have that on the left-hand side of the stage, and, like, da-da-da-da-da. And it was at this, like, dive bar in the city, like, this underground venue, which I had been there many times before at this party, but that didn't stop me from doing, I did like a kind of Dracula style beehive with like the two beehives. So in heels, I'm already 6'3". So then I had a beehive on and heels and I could barely stand on the stage because the venue was underground. So it was like low roofs. So that I hadn't thought about until I was on stage, but that's fine. It was fine. Yeah, it was good. It's good.
Okay, but logistics aside, how did it feel to be up there performing?
Incredible. Yeah, it really did. I don't know, people continue to ask, like, oh, don't you get nervous before you do a performance or a gig or, like, talking or emceeing or anything? And I'm like, no, I've just, like, I've never been, like, I'll be nervous to answer the phone at work. No, but there's something about like when you're in drag, or like I get nervous when I'm like doing my makeup and I'm like, okay, I've got to be there in 3 hours and I've mm-hmm. still got this in the go, or like I'm still packing my bag, like that stresses me out. But once you're there, it's like, well, there's nothing left to prepare or be unprepared for. Like how I am now is how I am for the show. So it kind of like takes the stress out of it because there's nothing else you can do at that point. So you just got to do it.
Okay, so this is interesting. So, but are you nervous before you're actually in drag?
No, I wouldn't say nervous. I'd say just like in like planning mode. Yeah. More stressed than nervous.
So is it because it's so exhausting to get ready for a performance that by the time you're ready, you're like, oh, yeah, I don't give a shit anymore.
Oh, it's like the hurdle. Like, you've already crossed that. Like, you're past it. You're in the home stretch. Like, the actual show is 3 minutes or 10 minutes in that case. But everything else is hours. Hours and hours and hours. So, yeah, by the time you're there, it's like, oh, this is the easy part. This is the fun part.
So, yeah, for anyone out there who's afraid of public speaking, just spend 5 hours getting ready for your 2-minute presentation and you'll be exactly. grand.
Yeah, comparatively, it's nothing.
Okay, so you did this first gig, you come off stage, you are like, wow, I need to keep doing this. What was the plan then?
Well, there's two things, right? Like, performing is one side of drag, but you can also just get in drag and go out. I don't think you have to be performing to also, like, kind of get that thrill of, you know, like, it's rare that you go out in drag and you don't get a compliment from someone. And not that that is the driving force, but, like, you know, it's a nice positive reinforcement of, like, yeah, I put all this effort into this thing and then here I am. And you don't have to perform to do that, right? So, but, yeah, after that night, it was like, okay, well, I've been going out in drag, which has been fun, but now that I've performed, I'm like, okay, this is an avenue that I could go down because I want to do more. Like, yeah, I only fit 5 concepts into that one show, so now I want to do another show where I can do more things. and thankfully, as the years have gone on, the anxiety about not having any shows in the future has subsided, and now I can be a bit more pointed in what I choose to perform rather than just smashing it all together. But
So what was happening in your life at that point? Like, so outside of drag, let's take a step away from Zelda.
I had left uni. I had studied in 2 different uni courses, both of them I left. Then I did my makeup diploma, thinking initially that I wanted to go into special effects and prosthetics, which I still sometimes think about. But yeah, and I think at that time when I'd started doing drag, I was just working in retail as a visual merchandiser, which I think also, like, I had access to a lot of clothes on discount. And initially, and, you know, sometimes still, like, the wardrobe is just things that you buy, right? They're not always like one-off custom things. So yeah, I kind of had access to all that stuff around me. But it was also like, I don't know, not in a depressing way, but this realization of like, okay, well, I've now left 2 uni courses. This other career path I want to go down isn't happening, and I'm now in my late 20s. Like, what am I doing? And yeah, I think having something to funnel a lot of creative energy in that kind of gave me a bit of a purpose, because I didn't have a lot of purpose in a career sense. And then, like, being gay, it's not like you're looking for your, you know, like, loving wife to, like, start your family. So you just left with a lot of free time.
Let's scratch at that a bit more, because I'm in a scratching mood.
Yeah.
So I often talk about how, because I was socialized in a world where I was told, oh, you're gay, so you're not going to be able to have these things. I just kind of accepted it and was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to have those things. And so lots of times I struggle with people who are like, well, one day you'll get married and one day you might have kids, because I'm like, no, I've been told I can't have that thing. So I'm like, no. And this statement that you've just made me think maybe you have a similar view.
Yeah, I would say so. The vision when you come out, or, you know, like realize, yeah, that you're gay, it's different from your straight contemporaries, right? Like they're all already thinking about the wife and the kids, and then that's the life cycle. But our life cycle isn't as defined, so you could really do anything. And if you're already seeing everyone else for the most part in your life doing the exact same thing, I'm like, wow, I'd like to do absolutely anything other than that. I think as well, like my brother, like I have one sibling, like he's older than me, he's straight, and I kind of already knew as a teenager, like he will live that life and I can witness that life through him, so I can do my own thing. And not that my parents would have ever put the pressure on either of us to live that life, but it was also like, well, he'll provide them with the grandchildren and the successful career and the all of that stuff, and then all of that pressure's taken off, so I can be free to kind of do whatever works for me. Yeah.
And you saw that as a choice?
Well, yeah, I wonder. No, I wouldn't say that I, like, chose to be the way that I am, but, yeah, it just happened to be the opposite of my brother. And yeah, like I've just never put much value in those sorts of things. Like even working with a lot of straight people just seems like their whole life is built around, well, my partner does this, and when we get married, it will be like this, and then we're going to move in together, and then we're going to pick out the kind of carpet we're going to get. Yeah. But you could have that same conversation with so many people so easily. Whereas when I talk to my queer friends, it's like they could say anything. Like you just can't predict where the conversation will go. And obviously that's a huge generalization, but do you know what I mean? It's like if you meet a straight person for the first time, you can kind of imagine the things that they might choose to bring up. But you meet a queer person for the first time and it could go anywhere and you could, you know.
Be sharing fisting stories, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it's just a funny one because, you know, the straight jacket, do you see what I did there?
Love
of it. Heterosexual people is very restrictive. But there's also something quite nice about being like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm going to do this. Okay, cool. All right, I guess I better go do this now. As opposed to the more historical queer experience where it's like, oh, okay, well, everyone's written me off, so I can just go and do whatever I want. Because that's like, if you've got anything to do, that's the, too many options.
Yeah, totally. It's like working somewhere where you have a uniform as opposed to somewhere where you don't have a uniform. You think that is like, oh, yeah, my God, that's so fun. I can wear whatever I want every day. And then a week in, you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, like I have to make this choice again.
Everyone's going to judge me for wearing this green scrunchie.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, if you just know what you're wearing every day, then you don't ever have to make that choice. But sometimes, yeah, that can be easier, certainly, but maybe more depressing.
Well, I guess that's it. Like, queer people have their existential crisis when they're at like 25, whereas straight people would have it at like 55.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're just kind of delaying the inevitable, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I do worry that like lots of queer youth are being pushed into this heteronormative ideal, and what's going to happen as a result of that. Like we're just all going to want kids and to move into picket fence houses.
Ugh. Yeah, I couldn't think of anything more boring.
Yeah, like when I hear people talking about the drama of finding a school for their child to go to, I just think, oh, fuck, I would just not want to be doing this. This is way too much emotional energy.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to go try to pick out which wig I want to wear tomorrow. Like, that's my, that's the most, I can face that. Maybe.
I have decision fatigue in the cereal aisle, for fuck's sake.
Exactly.
I'm not going to be able to pick a school.
Yeah. But like I've been fortunate in that I can, like my brother has children and I can be the like gay uncle and kind of get all of that without any of the responsibility. Yeah, but I think if you didn't have that, maybe there'd be more desire. Well, I suppose it's really just different people, right? Like I have some queer friends who have kids and, you know, it's like their whole life. They're amazing parents and it works out great. I suppose it just depends, yeah, who you are.
Do you think anyone would be able to be a drag queen and a parent?
Maybe not anyone. I think logistically, like the most boring way to answer that question is like, who would have the time?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm getting at.
I mean, I say that the performer that I had this gig with yesterday, Bay Park, she is a single parent. She's a bisexual and is raising, her son. And like, she took a few years off performing, but has now, started performing again. And if the passion is there, the drive is there. Also, if it's your hobby and it's your pastime, it's like how you recharge or whatever, right? So it's not always a burden.
Yeah.
It could be how you actually get through the rest of your life. But again, it depends because drag can be different things for different people. Like,
So do you ever think about giving up drag?
Sometimes, yeah. And I don't know why, because there are so many examples of this not being the case. But like, sometimes I think about like when I was a teenager and I would think of drag queens, like I wasn't into drag at all when I was really, really young. And I thought there was something kind of like pathetic about it. And I would think that the older you would get, the more pathetic it would become, which I don't really think of it that way anymore. But yeah, sometimes I have a twang of like, what am I like, some of the people at work who are like 20 years old think when I tell them I have a gig on the weekend, they think that like, oh, that's good for him. That makes me feel like, ooh. But yeah, I don't really think about it like that. I don't think I need to or want to quit drag, but I just will continue to be selective about it and do it on my terms and when I want to. Yeah, I don't think I would ever push for drag to become like a main source of income for me unless like instant fame happened, because that drive would lead to even more sacrifice, because the more gigs you do, the less time you have. And I think that is my challenge with drag, is just like how much time it takes up in your life. So I wouldn't necessarily quit. And I think, the main reason to quit would be to get more time back. But it would just be maybe less to do more other stuff. But it just depends what's happening.
Bit. So we've gone way, way off. Let's go back to hugs and kisses. Let's go back to Genki. Mm.
Mm.
So I know we spoke about nerves before in terms of getting ready to perform, but we didn't speak about nerves, that like a whole different level of nerves when putting on your own event.
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember the lead up to the first Genki?
Yes. Like, it was fun, but it's stressful. And I annoyingly, like, I don't want to half-ass anything. So like, we did a photo shoot with all of the performers, and I had a friend who's a graphic designer, like, do all of the artwork and like all these things that like I absolutely never recouped any of the costs for. But I was like, if I'm going to do it, I want to like do it. And also like knowing that I wouldn't be able to pay anyone particularly well, I was like, well, at least I can put on an event that they want to do, you know, and it can be something that they've said that they've done with pride rather than with embarrassment. Yeah, so we did big photo shoots. We had lots of artwork. I did lots of like street posters and stuff for that. The first one, I didn't do them again because it was ridiculously expensive, but that's okay. Yeah. Again, it's like I love organizing shit and a good checklist and Excel and all of that kind of stuff.
Ooh,
so
I fucking love it.
Even though it's a lot, yeah, I kind of loved it. And then because we would do a group number for the first show of every party, it was like we had a few rehearsal days with all the performers as well. But I also like booked, for the most part, friends, but also some people that I knew. So a lot of the DJs I already knew, the performers I already knew. So it was less daunting because it's not like yeah, there were less variables. But of course, for the first one, there were mm-hmm. plenty of, you know, just like, was everything going to work out with the venue, and what are they expecting this to bring in and all that kind of thing. But Hugs was unique in that the owner was more concerned with just putting on cool shit than turning a profit. Like, that bar was open 2 days a week, and it wasn't really there for that entirely, which took the pressure off, which was amazing.
So what happened on the first night?
What happened? It was pretty smooth from memory. I can't remember what I performed on that very first one. I remember there was something about Genki where every time it happened, I would like try something new with my makeup, and I look like busted in so many of the photos through those years. But it's okay. I don't know. It was just like, I did my makeup different to how I would normally do it almost every time, and I just look crazy, but it's fine.
You need to fail to learn.
Exactly.
So I'm getting a vibe from you, from the stories that you're telling me, that you don't half-ass anything in your life. So I'm really intrigued to hear what happened after that first night and what your plans were for Genki going forward.
Mm. Yeah, so after the first one, it was like, okay, this is the home of this party, because they were, like, Hugs were really happy with how the night went. It also just like ticked so many of the boxes of the right location. It was easy to get to via public transport. It was in like a safe area. The mix of attendees was everything I'd hoped for. And it was the right kind of vibe, right? Like, it was just fun. It was never like a very like sexy party. Like I have friends who run amazing, like, horny gay events, and they always sell out, and it's ridiculous and it's crazy. I'm like, oh, well, yeah, I'm sure it would be easier to sell tickets to a gig of people with abs on the cover as opposed to, like, Nami Amuro or something. But I was like, I don't care. I want to do this party, and this is the right spot for it. So, yeah, after the first one, it was like, all right, well, when will you have me back? Let's do it again. And then it became, yeah, like two to three times a year we would do it. It was pretty much like, I was conscious of, this is a niche part of musical interest, and it's a queer party, and it's a drag queen party. And it's like, if I do this, it's not going to work as a weekly gig, right? Because people will get over it. So I definitely didn't want to do it too often. Yeah, so we kind of went with a structure of like 2 to 3 times a year, which worked for like driving people's desire to go back, but also so that I could recoup all of my losses, because, yeah, like, I threw 10 of these parties and I never made a goddamn cent. But but it was like, that's not why I was putting them on, right? Like,
no, but it would be nice to make money, right?
It would be nice. I feel like if I did one now, I would find a way to make it more profitable. But yeah, certainly then it was like, oh, I'm more concerned that everyone else gets paid. So then, like, my conscience is clear. And sometimes it took a little while, but I did pay everyone. Yeah, but then if I got paid, like, that's a bonus, but who cares? It was like, anything I would have made, I would have just put into the next one. And I think the fun of it for me was like, okay, well, the next one's going to be for Halloween. So, like, we would do crazy Halloween decorations, mm-hmm. and like, the venue was so happy for us to just do whatever. Like, we could just staple gun shit to the wall and the next day just rip it off, and they weren't precious about anything like that. So, yeah, we had a lot of free reign to do a lot of fun stuff, which was, yeah, I care more about that than turning a profit. Like, who cares?
Do you still think that way?
Pretty much, yeah. It's probably why I don't have any money in my bank account.
Yeah, I guess anyone who gets into drag is probably more interested in the art, right?
I mean, especially in Australia, like, there are very few people who can do this as a full-time job. And even those that do, it's like, well, I don't know, what happens in 10 years where you don't want to do this anymore, and then what are you going to go into? So,
and your knees are fucked.
Yes, you can get some kick-ass gigs, or like you do an ad for someone and all of a sudden you've got a big income from drag, but it's not sustainable to look at it that way, I don't think. So I've never really looked at it that way. Instead, I've just looked at it as like a leech on my social time and bank account, but that's okay. Yeah.
Is that what keeps you going? Like, what keeps you going in it? What keeps you nourished?
Like, it's fun. It's fun, and I think, like, I love seeing what my, like, what other drag queens are doing. I love seeing what other events are doing. And when I see something that is really incredible, I'm like, God fucking damn it, why didn't I think of doing that? I'm going to do the next incredible thing. Or, like, I want my thing to make someone else feel like this. So, yeah, it's like healthy competition of like, oh, that was really amazing. Like, I want to do something that will impress you just as much. Yeah.
When does it feel hard?
It feels all the time. Yeah, it's funny because I love performing and I love doing drag and I've loved putting on many different kinds of events. It's hard when it takes up your entire life. It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy, and it's time that you can't... Yeah, like, I feel like as I've performed more and more through the years, like, my circle of friends has gotten smaller and smaller because I just don't have time to socialize with people like I used to. Yeah, which is kind of sad. But, yeah, there's only so many days in a week and hours in a day. And if you've got something on the horizon, you could be doing something for it. If you've got a gig in 2 months, you'll be thinking about that gig for the next 2 months. Or if you've got one next week, like, even if you have the outfit prepared and you've learnt the song or you've done all the prep or whatever, you could still practice it again. So until that gig is done, you're always preparing for the gig. So it's just, it takes a lot of time away from the rest of your life. And that's hard.
Okay. So you were running the night and then dum-dum-dum, the pandemic hit and Hugs and Kisses obviously had to close as a result. And then it closed down during those lockdowns?
Well, actually. So it closed.
Oh, I got it wrong.
Yeah, it closed. It technically closed just beforehand. So it closed in January of 2020. Yeah. And then, like, Melbourne closed, like, a month later, pretty much. But I don't know that it was truly, truly, like, done, dusted in that January. Like, they did a big final party, but I don't know what the long-term plan was, like, if they were going to redo it and reopen it something else or whatever. But certainly the pandemic, like, was the nail in the coffin for any, like, butterfly transformations for that venue. It was, yeah, it was all over. But... yeah, we had done, I think we'd done a party for Halloween in 2019, I believe. And then when we found out that, yeah, the venue was closing, we like booked in, yeah, a final Genki and it was like maybe 2 weekends before the venue closed for good. I loved it because it was number 10. So I got a nice clean 10 events there across the years, which was very satisfying. Yeah. Yeah,
you wouldn't want to end on 9. Yeah, that would just be horrific.
That was the reason that I hustled to get the next gig in. I was like, that can't be the legacy.
So in this very ordered thinking that you have, what were your first thoughts when you found out that Genki was no longer going to be part of Hugs and Kisses?
Well, it's been... 3 years now, and it's still something that I think about because so much of that party was successful because of that venue, both in the freedoms that they allowed me in running the party there, but also the location and the space and people's existing relationship with that venue that then also came to that party. And yeah, I've always felt a bit like without that venue, like, could Genki work somewhere else? Like, what is a sister venue to Hugs and Kisses that could work, not even so much in the relationship sense of myself and the bar, but just like the physical space. Because through the years, a lot of other venues in the city with a stage of a similar size have closed, or, you know, the clientele has changed to a point where would this be the best venue for a queer event? Maybe not, or whatever. So yeah, it's just like few options. Yeah, and then also running an entire event almost single-handedly was, yeah, a lot of work. So when Hugs and Kisses closed, I was kind of like, well, it might be nice to just like sit on that for a little while and relaunch it when the time is right, if at all. Yeah, and then obviously the pandemic happened, and then coming out of that, there's even less venues to choose from. But now that the world has returned to normal, I'm like, maybe now is the time to do it again. But yeah, it's still that venue struggle. But there's got to be somewhere out there.
Mm. So I think we should wrap up our conversation. But yeah, before we do, I want to ask you a super cheesy question.
Love it.
If you could go back in time to that very first performance of Zelda and have a conversation with her just as she comes off stage,
yeah,
what advice would you give her?
Oh, well, okay, so I didn't say this when we talked about that moment earlier, but when I came off stage, there were two of my friends who were there from work. And the first thing they said to me, like literally the first thing they said was, you have to do that again.
Because you have to have an opportunity to do it well.
Oh!
Sorry.
Oh, that's good. They're like, you really fucked that up. You got to try again. Ah, it's so good. No, because I think like I used to be a much more like reserved person, and I still really am. But as I said before, I give it shit less, so I'm more happy to talk to people. Mm. But I think they saw in that very first performance like that I was quite free, and I think, yeah, they were coming at it from that lens of like, oh, wow, I've never seen you like that. You need to do that more, because we just kind of saw you for the first time. So I think I would say to myself something along those lines of like, this is your opportunity to develop who you are and be a bit more free.
To take it.
Yeah.
Do you have any memories of Genki at Hugs and Kisses, or maybe clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what it is you got up to. You can also find me on Facebook and Instagram if reaching out on the website is a bit too much. My handle on both is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Zelda by listening to her podcast, Death to Everyone, which she co-hosts with Lazy Susan, who happened to be last week's guest if you are keeping up with the show. Or you can follow her on Instagram at Zelda Moon. And if you're really curious to find out more about this week's featured night, Genki, why not go to the Instagram page, which is at Genki Party. And that has flyers and photos of people who have dressed up and shown out for the night. If you enjoyed this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform, or just tell other people who you think might be interested. My name's Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.